From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is meeting with Republican leaders in Philadelphia today at their party retreat. Lots to talk about there, including Obamacare and taxes, but also foreign policy. And Trump made some news on that front last night. Speaking with ABC, the president was asked about his potential plans to suspend immigration from certain countries.
You're looking at people that come in many cases, in some cases, with evil intentions. I don't want that. They're ISIS. They're coming under false pretense. I don't want that. I'm going to be the president of a safe country. We have enough problems. Now, I'll absolutely do safe zones in Syria for the people. I think that Europe has made a tremendous mistake by allowing these millions of people to go into Germany and various other countries. And all you have to do is take a look. It's a disaster what's happening over there. I don't want that to happen here.
Now, you may have missed it, but did you hear him say safe zones? According to the Associated Press and other outlets, President Trump is expected to order the Pentagon and State Department to come up with a plan for setting up safe places within Syria for Syrian nationals. Here and Now, security analyst Jim Walsh is with us now with more on this. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jeremy.
So explain what a safe zone is. Is this just a rebranding of a no-fly zone, which Hillary Clinton had been in favor of?
Essentially, that's right. So, and much is, you know, undetermined at this point. This is a leaked draft of a proposal for a plan. But the idea would be that we would carve out a piece of Syria for ourselves and that we would protect it. Now, does that mean U.S. soldiers on the ground to protect those refugees? Does it mean U.S. warplanes flying overhead to prevent the Syrians from attacking them? Does it mean additional forces to protect the U.S. forces that are on the ground? Because obviously, that's a sweet target for ISIS. It's certainly a lot closer to hit them there than it is to hit the U.S. abroad. So lots of unanswered questions. But the idea is we would grab a piece of Syria, we would allow civilians to move to that area, and we would protect them.
Wouldn't it have to mean some of those things and more U.S. involvement in Syria? Because this is one of the reasons the Obama administration was not in favor of doing safe zones.
Well, it wasn't just the Obama administration. It was also the Pentagon. So it'll be interesting to see how they weigh in here. The reporting doesn't really identify who would be the provider. This might be aspirational more than anything else. Turkey has talked about doing that. It's done it in a limited way, but that's mostly along the Turkish border. I think it remains to be seen who would be the provider. But what strikes me about this is it's sort of the tail wagging the dog. We are letting U.S. immigration policy set and determine our Middle East policy. Normally, it's the other way around, right? You figure out what your national security interests are. You figure out who your friends and enemies are in the Middle East, and you come up with a strategy. We seem to be heading towards a safe zone strategy that's really a function of immigration policy.
Well, and it sounds like Russia is urging caution on this as well.
Well, of course, the Russians don't want the U.S. to put troops or grab a piece of Syrian territory. We'll have to see how the Syrians feel about that. The Russians say they weren't consulted. The Turks, who have been in favor of the concept for themselves, have been cautious about it. I would say this. If it were to happen, underline if, because it's a plan, you know, it's a draft of a possible plan, lots of steps here. But if it were to happen, it would represent a major change in U.S. foreign policy.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Jim, because you've been an expert on North Korea for a long time, and we've got some news that the highest-ranking defector in years yesterday spoke at a news conference in South Korea, and he said the days of the country's leader, Kim Jong-un, are numbered. What's going on there?
Well, my quick reaction to that is don't hold your breath. There's a history to this. And some of the projects I've run, research projects in North Korea, we interviewed defectors. That's sort of a sticky business, you know, especially if the defectors now work for the South Korean government. You know, what do you expect them to say up on the dais? They're going to say, you know, the end is nigh. So I take that with not a grain of salt, but a pound of salt. It seems that the sanctions may have had some impact on North Korea, but that hasn't slowed their missile tests. It hasn't slowed their nuclear development. So could be true. You know, academic scholars are terrible at predicting when collapse will happen. They're great at explaining it afterwards, terrible at predicting it. But I wouldn't rely on a defector to tell me when it was going to happen. We have a long history of that, and those proclamations have turned out wrong more often than right.
Do you expect that the changing relationship between the U.S. and China is going to hurt our ability to deal with North Korea?
Well, I've always said that there's no solving the North Korea issue unless China and the U.S. work from the same page. Now, obviously, Mr. Trump has several areas of disagreement. Will those bleed over and poison relations? That remains to be seen. But that is something worth watching.
That's here now, security analyst Jim Walsh, who is with the MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a busy first week for Donald Trump. He's called for an investigation into voter fraud, signed executive orders, met with automakers, pledged to cut regulations, said waterboarding works, jump-started the Keystone XL and Dakota pipelines, just to name a few things. So how are Trump voters reacting? We're joined now on Skype by Rich Heidel of Hobart, Wisconsin, just outside Green Bay. He's active in his state's Republican Party and voted for Donald Trump. So, Rich, give us your report card. How are you feeling?
So far, speaking not only for myself, but probably legions of others, I think we're very, very pleased with what President Trump has done. I think perhaps much like your New England Patriots, no one can run a ball fast enough, kick a ball straight enough, or throw a ball far enough for the avid fan. So no matter what Mr. Trump does, it's good, but probably not enough.
Well, first of all, my sympathies to your Packers, but many people would disagree with that, though, that right out of the gate, he made a lot of fumbles to continue. And the continued squabble over how many people came to his inauguration or how many popular votes he lost by. Don't you want to see your president and the man you voted for rise above those things? Weren't those missteps?
First of all, I don't know that they were missteps. Personally speaking, again, I could care less. I'm all about the future of this country. I'm not about counting heads on the mall in Washington on Inauguration Day. I am about the executive orders, the directives that Mr. Trump has promulgated in the first 6 days or so here.
Well, let's take a look at those. Do you worry about spending? Estimates of up to $15 billion for a wall on the border at a time when fewer immigrants are coming across and Mexico is not going to pay.
I don't necessarily buy either one of your statements as being truth. I do see the wall as a national security item. And in my view, national security is right at the top of the list of governmental responsibilities.
Well, according to every accounting, there are fewer immigrants coming across. I'm imagining that some people feel that any are a problem. But also Mexico has said, and Donald Trump has said, that at least initially now Mexico is not paying. Does that worry you? That was a pledge.
No, it does not worry me at all. What does worry me, though, has been the rate at which immigrants have been coming across the border. This border is a sieve. This border has been non-existent. And I don't frankly care who pays for it, but we have to address the responsibility of the government.
Yeah. What about the pledge to drain the swamp? Many of his cabinet appointees have been criticized for things like, well, Steven Mnuchin up for Treasury Secretary made billions off the 2008 housing crisis. His education pick, Betsy DeVos, her family donated $200 million to the Republican Party. Tom Price for Health and Human Services, accused of buying stock in companies that he was then legislating favorably for. Now, these people may be voted for, but this is the kind of swamp activity that Trump promised to get rid of.
Well, he did promise to drain the swamp. I guess to all of the examples you just provided us with, I've got two words, Hillary Clinton. You know, being associated with money is not in and of itself a crime. What is wrong is what you do with it or what it does to you. The mere fact that people have been successful, that they're knowledgeable, that they've accumulated personal wealth or they know people of personal wealth is not an indictment on anybody in this country.
Okay. Well, what do you make of the women marching this past weekend, many wearing the pink hats, who cannot wrap their brains around a man as president who boasted that he grabbed women's genitals, especially if they didn't, you know, ask him to. I mean, do you have daughters? Is that something that nags you?
No, it does not. I'm married. I have a daughter. I'm also a male. And I know what goes on in locker rooms. But I also know what went on in the Oval Office 20 years ago, too. And if we were to compare one against the other, there is no comparison.
You're talking about the Bill Clinton scandal.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Rich, what is it that you would like to see, if there's anything more from the man that you voted for in the Oval Office? Is there something that you're sitting there saying, what about this?
Well, as you know, Robin, I guess in a week from today, I suppose, President Trump has stated that he will be making his Supreme Court appointment public. I think we have, 10 issues. Most of, not all of them, have been unresolved. We've got health care. We got terrorism. We've got a $20 trillion national debt. There's immigration. There's a military strength. There's jobs in the economy, Second Amendment rights. I'd be hard-pressed to put any one of these at the top of the list. I think abortion or pro-life is right up there. This speaks volumes as to what a society thinks about the most defenseless members of it. So, as I said at the outset, I don't think Mr. Trump can kick a ball far enough, throw it straight enough, or run it fast enough to keep people like me happy.
And you feel he's done all three, though. Are you proud?
I am proud, yes. I'm greatly relieved, too.
That's Rich Heidel, a Trump voter from Hobart, Wisconsin. Rich, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate your time and your ears.
President Donald Trump is already moving to crack down on immigration and border security, as he said he would throughout the campaign. Trump yesterday signed two executive orders that, among other things, instruct Homeland Security to take immediate steps to plan and build that southern border wall, increase the number of border patrol agents and detention centers, and step up deportations. The moves mark a change for immigration policy in the U.S., but how does our system compare to others around the world? John Scretany is co-director of the Center for Comparative Immigration Studies at the University of California, San Diego. And professor, is there any country in the world that has a more open immigration policy right now than the U.S.?
More open? Well, I would say there's a lot of different dimensions to this. The United States attracts more immigrants in terms of sheer numbers than any other country in the world. But one of the interesting stories going on right now is happening in the Middle East. And there's a lot of talk now, especially in Europe, about refugees. In the United States, there's a lot of talk about refugees, extreme vetting, all that sort of thing. The country of Jordan is really fascinating because its population is only about 7 million people. And right now, they've added about 2.7 million refugees to that population of 7 million. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about, you know, that would be like the United States adding almost 100 million refugees. I mean, just imagine what that would be like. And, you know, Jordan's not the richest country in the world. So that suggests a lot of openness.
But you would probably also call that an emergency situation. These countries are taking in a lot of people because of an immediate situation that will not last forever. What about just generally the immigration systems that are in place year after year after year around the world? How does the U.S. compare?
Well, that's a good question. And there's a lot of different dimensions we could go on. If you want to look globally and see who's doing a good job of immigration control, I would tell everyone to look to the country of Japan. And it's a fascinating story right there. You have a country of about 127 million people. It's still the third largest economy in the world. It's one of the richest places in the world. If you go there, you see a beautiful country of wealth and cleanliness. And one of the things you'll also notice is that there's almost no immigrants there. The population of immigrants in Japan is only about 2 million people. The population of undocumented immigrants in Japan is it's less than 70,000 compared to 11 million in the United States. And think about this, Jeremy. In terms of refugee and asylee acceptance, Japan, again, a country of 127 million, accepted only 27 in 2015. And all this is happening in a country that is literally shrinking in terms of its demography.
Right.
A third of the population of Japan is over the age of 65. The population now, about 126, 127 million, that's going to be about 83 million by the end of this century. And yet they manage to control immigration. They manage to dissuade immigrants from coming. They manage to avoid accepting what, you know, many would say would be their fair share of refugees and asylees in the world. They've got immigration control down.
And their economy has suffered greatly because of their tight immigration policies, which even though their birth rate is low, they also aren't allowing people to come in and fill the void there. What about the United Kingdom? How do they compare to what we do here in the U.S.?
The United Kingdom is an interesting story, and I like to talk about it in relation to Japan because the UK is also an island. And, you know, it's our land border with Mexico, which is a major source of undocumented immigration here. The UK doesn't have a land border, and certainly they don't have a land border with a poorer country. Yet the UK has about 600,000 undocumented immigrants in a population of 64 million. Of course, the United States has about 330 million people. So they are accepting a lot of immigrants.
And how do they decide who they're going to let in?
Well, that's an interesting story. So they do something that there's some advocates in the U.S. say that we could learn a little bit from the U.K. The U.K. has something called the Migration Advisory Committee. It doesn't formally have any power, but it's a group of scholars and other kinds of educated professionals who go about the country collecting data and also, and I think this is important, actually talking to employers, looking at what's going on, looking at where the labor needs are, looking at whether domestic training might be able to supply those labor needs, or looking to see if, in fact, this is a real shortage here and we and the UK could benefit from immigration. Now, the government in the UK can reject those findings, but the fact of the matter is it's a comprehensive kind of nimble body that is always there to provide some information. But I think most people in the UK trust what they have to say.
And we don't do anything like that in this country?
In the U.S., what we do is we tend to rely on the word of employers. Employers say that they can't find anyone, and we tend to believe them. And then we try to make sure that they pay any immigrant workers who they hire the prevailing wage, that they pay they pay them what an American worker would receive. And so it. You know, in a sense, it's an admirable system because it's kind of in real time where the openings are. But we have to trust the employers there. And employers are under a lot of pressure to cut costs. Migrants who come from poorer nations, they will see a wage that most Americans would look at and, you know, raise an eyebrow and say, I wouldn't take that job for that. For a migrant coming would say, that is 2 to 3 times maybe more what I can make in my home country. So they're just going to be more willing to accept lower pay than American workers are. And again, you know, employers are under pressure, you know, shareholders, competition, globalization, they're under pressure to keep costs low. So there's going to be pressures on them and incentives with them to hire immigrant workers where they can.
We're speaking with John Scretany, who is co-director of the Center for Comparative Immigration Studies at the University of California. Now, you talked about the UK. People have also talked about Canada's system, and this is Jeff Sessions, who's now been nominated to be Attorney General for the United States. He was in 2013 when he said this, was a senator from Alabama, and he praised Canada's immigration system. Here he is.
We have both the enormous illegal flow of people into the country, as well as a legal flow that is not evaluated in a way that other advanced nations do when they execute their policies of immigration, for example, like Canada.
How different is Canada's immigration system from ours?
Well, Canada is a fascinating comparison with the United States, Jeremy, because we're both settler states. We're both countries that came about from colonial powers who took over land from indigenous populations and then had incentives to try to settle vast swaths of land. But Canada's taken a different approach. In the U.S., as Senator Sessions said, we really privilege family reunification. Family is really at the heart of our immigration policy, so that about 2/3 of permanent residents, green card holders, come to the United States through a family reunification mechanism. And in the United States, only about 13% come from some kind of employment-sponsored preference. In Canada, it's almost reversed. About 2/3 of the immigrants come for economic reasons. Only about 25% of the migrants to Canada come through family reunification. So Canada set up the system. It's usually called a point system. Australia has it as well, where they make it easier for migrants to come if they have English or French skills, if they have higher education, if they have work experience, if they have already arranged employment in Canada, and if they have experience with living in Canada. And Canada, has about 1 out of 5 people is foreign-born there.
Hmm. So if you take the best things from all of these systems, what would the ideal immigration system be in the United States. How could we make sure that we're getting the best people, as Trump has said, and not having people who are a security risk come in, but also make sure that you're not just bringing in, you know, highly trained scientists, so that you have a wide range of immigrants?
It's a great question, and it's a debate that we have to have, and it's a debate that we haven't had, because the questions you're asking are questions about what kind of country we want to be. Should immigration policy be about economic growth? Should it be about humanitarian concerns? Should it be about families? Should it be about populating the nation? Should it be about diversity? And so we need to be clear about what our goal is. If it's purely about economic growth, then maybe, yes, we should be moving it away from family reunification and toward employment-based concerns. If it's about more than that, if it's about humanitarian concerns, it's about strong families, then maybe we should think about keeping it the way we have it.
But even though we have not had that conversation in this country, we're still bringing in a lot of people legally into the United States every year.
That's true. We lead the world in accepting migrants. We hundreds of thousands during the 1990s, the boom economy then, we were getting more than a million a year. And so, yeah, the numbers are coming. People are voting with their feet. Fewer from Mexico. That's something that tends to get lost in the debates leading up to the election. Certainly the undocumented migration from Mexico is nearing zero. But there's still a great demand to come to the United States. And the more we open our doors, the more people will come here. So, you know, there's a debate to be had really about how we want to arrange the system, how we want to organize our visas. And that's going to be a debate about more than economics. It's going to be a debate about rights and values.
Speaking of rights and values, Donald Trump has, as we know, talked about building a wall along the Mexican border, something that a lot of people in this country look at and say that is the opposite of what America is about, to have a big wall on the southern border. On the other hand, a lot of other countries have walls on their borders. In fact, we have walls in parts of our border.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And when there's immigration debates going on in the United States, one of the things I hear from immigration restrictionists is, why even have a country if you're not going to have borders? And I understand what they're saying. The basic model for the nation state is a model of membership, and it's a model of linkages of people to their government through this mechanism called citizenship. And we don't really have, I think, good language for understanding the role that immigrants play, their place in the overall fabric of the nation. I think that's some conversations that we're going to have.
That's John Scretany, who's a professor of sociology and co-director of the Center for Comparative Immigration Studies at the University of California, San Diego. John, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
In Philadelphia today, congressional Republicans and President Trump are attending the annual GOP policy retreat. Way up on the agenda, repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. Today, Trump, speaking to Republicans, said Obamacare is a disaster he can't wait to replace. And before that, House Speaker Paul Ryan said he wants it done in the next 3 months.
This law is collapsing five states. Five states only have one health care insurance company, one health care plan. One out of three counties in America only have one health care plan. That is not a choice. That is a monopoly.
NPR health policy reporter Allison Kojak joins us from the GOP retreat in Philadelphia. And Allison, so Speaker Ryan wants to repeal and come up with some replacement of the ACA by April. But are he or Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell spelling out any plan?
They don't have a real detailed plan as of yet, not that we've seen. They talk about the plan that they're going to come up with. And as you said, Speaker Ryan has said they want to get this done by April, which means they're going to have to come up with something pretty soon. What they do have done is put some, you know, ideas out there that are shaping up and are being repeated enough that we know they're likely to be included. That includes replacing the mandate with tax credits so that people will be able to buy insurance at a lower, you know, with the help of government tax credit, and health savings accounts, which are tax favored accounts where people can save money and pay for their health care costs through those.
Well, and their concerns about both of those. And I'm wondering, are Republicans, you know, what's the feel that you get? Are they nervous about this? They've said they wanted details and to hammer it out because they know they're going to own it.
Yeah, they seem to be a bit nervous about it in the sense that they haven't come up with a unified plan. There are several different plans floating around out there, and the promises that they're making are changing day to day. I mean, President Trump has said he wants insurance for everybody, and immediately after he said that, a lot of Republican leaders have walked that back and said, no, we are offering access to everybody. They don't want to overpromise and underdeliver and get in the same trouble that the Obama administration got in.
Now, Republican senators this week floated a plan to let states decide whether or not to keep Obamacare. Is that gaining any support?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting plan because I haven't heard anything like it before. Senator Susan Collins and Bill Cassidy floated this idea that they should just turn it over to the governors. And certain states could choose, if they wanted to just stay in the Affordable Care Act, keep Obamacare. And states that don't like it, those governors could opt into this other plan, which would offer, you know, again, tax credits to help people buy insurance. It looks like on the face of it that it would be a very, very generous tax credit system and would cost the government a lot of money. They've only had one other senator sign on as of yet. That's Lindsey Graham of South Carolina.
Well, and just briefly, Ryan has long pushed for overhauling Social Security and Medicare. Those are the biggest federal health expenses. But President Trump campaigned on not changing those. So tension there?
Yeah, Speaker Ryan mentioned it again this morning, at least indirectly. But President Trump has said he does not want to touch Medicare, at least not part of this repeal and replace. But it seems like Speaker Ryan still has that in his plans.
That's Allison Kojak, NPR's health policy reporter at the Republican Policy Retreat in Philadelphia. It's going to go on for 3 days. President Trump speaking there today. Allison, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, Robin.
Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto said today that he will not make a scheduled trip to the White House next week. He was supposed to meet with President Trump to discuss the future of trade between the two countries. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd is here with the latest. And Peter, President Trump says both men agreed to cancel the meeting. What else do we know?
Well, one of the issues the men were supposed to discuss was the future of NAFTA, but this was really a fight over that wall because Mexicans were really, really deeply offended yesterday when Trump issued that executive order that directed the U.S. government to get started on building the wall. And last night, ABC's David Muir hinted at this when he asked Trump about the president's plan to make Mexico pay for it.
That wall will cost us nothing.
But you talked often about Mexico paying for the wall, and you again say they'll pay us back. Mexico's president said in recent days that Mexico absolutely will not pay, adding that it goes against our dignity as a country and our dignity as Mexicans. He says,
well,
quite simply, they're not paying.
David, I think he has to say that. He has to say that. But I'm just telling you, there will be a payment. It will be in a form, perhaps a complicated form. And you have to understand, what I'm doing is good for the United States. It's also going to be good for Mexico.
And Jeremy, Trump actually needled Peña Nieto even further today because he tweeted this morning that if Mexico doesn't want to pay for the wall, well, then Peña Nieto should, in fact, cancel the trip. So at that point, you know, what choice did the president have, Mexican president have?
Well, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said today that the administration would try to reschedule the meeting between Trump and Peña Nieto. How significant is this for the relationship between these two countries?
It's interesting because the relationship between the two countries has been relatively good over the past few decades. And, you know, I spent some time in Mexico covering the U.S. election this fall, and I spoke to a lot of Mexicans who were very angry, both at Trump but also at Peña Nieto. They're still talking about that meeting the two had back in August when Trump was running
during
for president.
The campaign. Yeah,
during the campaign. And so a lot of deja vu going on here. Mexicans really urging their president not to make the exact same mistake again. And so I think a lot of work still needs to be done if these two countries are going to get back to where they were.
That's Here Now's Peter O'Dowd. Peter, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, before President Peña Nieto canceled his trip, I spoke with Luis de la Calle. He's a former undersecretary for Mexico's Ministry of Economy who helped design and promote NAFTA, that trade deal that President Trump wants to renegotiate or scrap altogether. And I started by asking him about Trump's recent trip to the Carrier air conditioning plant in Indiana. Trump had just been elected and he had cut a deal to keep several hundred Carrier jobs from going to Mexico. And he used the visit to rail against NAFTA.
We have NAFTA, which is a total and complete disaster. It's a total and complete disaster. It's a one-lane highway into Mexico. Nothing coming our way, everything going their way.
Is that how Mexicans view NAFTA?
Not at all. If you ask most Mexicans, they'll think that it's beneficial mostly for the U.S. So Mexico has become a very large market for the U.S. And, of course, we are a very large exporter to the U.S. It's a two-way street from which we both benefit. So I don't think President Trump has it right.
Well, when you say you both benefit, we do notice that the poverty rate in Mexico is about the same as it was in the early 1990s. Has NAFTA really been that good for the people of Mexico?
Yes. I mean, poverty is not measured in exactly the same way today as it was 25 years ago. So Mexico, I mean, if you travel around Mexico and you talk to Mexicans and you see their educational attainment, the standards of living, and you see that most Mexicans are much better today than they were 25 years ago. But I mean, NAFTA has made a contribution, no question. It has.
Do you think that Mexico has benefited more from NAFTA than the United States has?
Well, we opened more than the U.S. I mean, the U.S. was already an open economy when we joined NAFTA. And actually, the U.S. Spent decades preaching Mexico that we should open up our markets, that we should join the market economy, that we should join the world and compete in the world markets. It was a hard thing for Mexico to do. We went from a closed economy based on oil or mining to an economy that is now based on competition. Many firms in Mexico actually failed, went bankrupt because of the opening to the U.S. and Canada. And most people thought when we negotiated NAFTA that Mexico was, of course, the country that would lose to large corporations from the U.S. that were very competitive in the world markets already. So the effort was made on our side. But it's interesting that today we have the reverse, that it is the U.S. that has doubts as to whether it can compete with Mexico, and that now little Mexico is trying to convince a Republican administration that free trade is good for you.
Well, and what do you think is at stake if NAFTA is renegotiated? What's at stake for Mexico?
Well, I mean, a sense of direction. Mexico, as I mentioned, take a difficult decision for us, which was to open to the world markets, to trust the U.S. If we took this NAFTA renegotiations and as an excuse to go back to the way we used to do things before, which was a closed economy that looked only inwards, that would be a significant mistake. And if I was in charge, I would argue to President Peña that Mexico should reaffirm its commitment to open markets, regardless of what the U.S. does. And if the U.S. becomes protectionist, we should not follow that lead.
Well, if the U.S. does move in that direction and throw NAFTA out, let's say, would you argue that President Peña Nieto should do a bilateral trade deal with the United States so that you have a strong trading partnership with your biggest trading partner?
I don't think we should do that. I mean, NAFTA works well. NAFTA reflects the integration among Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. We are part of the same production line, if you wish. Disrupting that would be contrary to the interests of North America. It would only benefit other countries around the world. Your example on the air conditioning units out of Indiana, the Carrier, is a good one. Because if we cannot manufacture jointly air conditioning units in North America, we'll only help the South Koreans, Samsung and LG, that are the largest producers of air conditioning around the world, and have a free trade agreement with the U.S. So if we put obstacles to our trade, we'll benefit Korea, China, Germany, Japan, and other countries around the world.
I want to ask you about something else. We heard again from President Trump this week that he is going to build the wall. He wants the wall built on the border with Mexico and that Mexico will pay for the wall. What do you make of that? And what should President Peña Nieto do in response to that?
Well, I mean, if the U.S. wants to build something on its side of the border, they can do it. I mean, I think symbolically it's a rejection of Mexico. I think it will have an ethnic content to it, because he will not build walls with countries that are not brown and don't speak English. And I think it would be a waste of money for U.S. citizens and taxpayers. If the U.S. chooses to build a wall, for every 10 miles, you might probably build 30 schools. For every 50 miles, maybe 4 or 5 hospitals. For every 100 miles, maybe a large Navy ships. So there is an opportunity cost.
Well, Trump is saying Mexico will pay for the wall.
Well, but that is deceiving to U.S. taxpayers, because even if he imposes a tax on Mexicans, those monies, once in the hands of the U.S. government, could use to fund national public radio or schools around the U.S. So there is an opportunity cost to those monies, and wasting those monies in a wall that is not necessary, in my way of thinking, you wouldn't be using those monies to the best possible use.
What do you think of where this relationship has gotten between the U.S. and Mexico, that we're talking about building walls and making Mexico pay for it and sending back all of the people who have come into the U.S. illegally, et cetera?
I mean, I think that is quite interesting, that the fact that Mexico has been at the center of the debate in the U.S., Americans might wonder, why is Mexico in the news every day? Why is the president of the U.S. talking about Mexico all the time? Well, because maybe Mexico matters to the U.S. more than people think in their daily lives. And the U.S. should want to have a thriving neighbor. I would appeal to the sense of fairness of Americans. I mean, the only thing we're asking Americans is, give us a chance to compete. We are not asking for subsidies, transfers, or anything, just a chance to work hard, preferably in Mexico, but also for some Mexicans that have chosen to do it in the U.S., also in the U.S.
That's Luis de la Calle, who is a former undersecretary for Mexico's Ministry of Economy, where he helped design and promote NAFTA back in the 90s. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy. Nice talking to you.
We're well into the new year, so what's hot in the food world in 2017? Here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has been checking out the scene at a couple of California food shows this week. She joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Kathy, I picture you, you know, with sunglasses and a wig, sneaking
through. Mini skirt and spike heels, you got it.
Tell us about the shows.
Well, first I went to a small show at Fort Mason called the Good Food Show, and this is a really small, curated show of 142 thoughtful, responsible crafters. And the minute I got there, I met Eric Sorkin from Run Amok Maple Syrup. They age them in different types of wood. They age them in rye barrels, aged bourbon barrel aged, rum barrel aged. So you have in front of you the bourbon barrel aged. Okay. So why don't you just take the top off and first smell it, because immediately you will know this is not normal maple syrup.
No.
Give a little taste.
Right. Hold on,
it's got the sweet, smooth, silky, buttery flavor.
Oh, that is not my cousin Peggy's maple syrup.
Exactly.
But it is so good.
To me, it's like grown-up maple syrup, like maple syrup aged in this wood, and it almost tastes like there's booze in there, but there's not.
Yeah. We'll have all of these things, all of these items, by the way, so you can see them at herenow.org. You also have a ginger-flavored hot sauce from the company Omnivore.
Omnivore makes fabulous seasoned salt, but this is their brand new product. It's called Volcano Ginger, and it is a hot sauce, not that spicy at all, filled with fresh ginger, and pairs really well with oysters or crab or rice dishes, steamed vegetables. I really like this, and Omnivore makes wonderful products that you can use in all kinds of creative ways. So that was a really fun thing.
I just took a pinky taste. It's really good, and the ginger comes through.
And it's not killer spicy. So then I went to the Moscone Center in downtown San Francisco to the Winter Fancy Food Show, which is a truly gigantic show with 1,600 exhibitors from around the world and over 80,000 products. I noticed all kinds of familiar foods infused with new, not-so-familiar flavors, kind of flavors that are most often found in other cultures. So think of maybe sriracha potato chips or turmeric soda, or Thai basil vinegar.
And you sent us a bottle of Thai basil full-strength drinking vinegar. It says dilute one part with 4 parts water. So tell us more as I mix it with some seltzer.
Yeah, these are really interesting. There's a restaurant in Portland, Oregon, and also in Brooklyn called Pak Pak, wonderful Thai food. And they make these drinking vinegars, is what they call it. And they're called Som, S-O-M. And there's all kinds of flavors, pomegranate, ginger. But the Thai basil, I thought, was so interesting. And if you add a little bit of that to seltzer, it's the best way to taste it. Of course, you could also add it to rum or tequila. It's savory and herby and subtle, and I find it so interesting. And you can also cook with these vinegars to glaze a chicken. Just wonderful, interesting flavors and very healthy for you.
Okay.
What do you think?
Oh, that's wonderful.
Isn't that refreshing?
I mean, you taste the basil, and then later comes the vinegar, but it's not too strong at all. It's
exactly.
That's great.
There's also another tasting vinegar. This was a big trend at these shows, called Fire Cider, which is a flavored apple cider vinegar, and we'll have more about it on the website. Another very interesting drinking vinegar.
Okay. There is something here I have to mention, because as soon as Emiko opened the cap, it is an unbelievably powerful smell. It is the Rampkraut.
I knew you were going to bring that up. Yes, it is a stinker. You know, we've talked about this every spring. Ramps are wild leeks. This is like a kraut, as in sauerkraut, made with wild ramps and salt, and it's fermented. This is from Blackberry Farm in Wayland, Tennessee. They make all kinds of charcuterie and cheeses, and give it out a taste. It is strong and interesting and powerful. And if you love ramps, if you love onions, if you love leeks, you're going to love this.
Wow. I do love it. What power?
Right?
Yeah. It's kind of seaweed.
It's not subtle.
Mm-mm. Boy, and just think, I just knocked back Thai basil, drinking vinegar, omnivore, ginger twist, hot sauce, and maple syrup that was treated like bourbon. Just in a few
exactly.
minutes' time. But it wakes you up.
It certainly does. And believe it or not, everything that you've tasted is really good for you. These drinking vinegars are great for your digestive system. The ramps are just a great naturally fermented product. And maple syrup comes from a tree. And how interesting that they throw it into a barrel.
Okay, there's so much more. We'll have it on our website. You found black sesame brittle, flavored pumpkin seeds. Just quick, though, humister?
Humister, this is a brand new company. It is a make-your-own hummus kit. Everything's in this little jar, and their philosophy is no preservatives, super fresh, part of this whole DIY trend, and also just fits into that whole popularity of the meal kits. They send you the ingredients, and you put it together. So if you love hummus, check it out.
We're talking unexpected flavors and familiar foods. I am loving this Thai basil drinking vinegar in seltzer. Who knew? With Kathy Gunst. Kathy, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
But Jeremy, I wouldn't recommend eating all of this at once, which I just did. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.